Howdy folks, this is Scott Parker and you're listening to episode 19 of the ZappaCast for July of 2014. In this episode, we're going to be continuing our conversation that we began last time with the incredible Pauline Butcher Bird, and she's going to be asking us questions and we're going to be asking her questions, and we all had a very good time doing it, as I'm sure you can hear. If you have not done so, rush right out and buy Pauline's book, Freak Out My Life with Frank Zappa, which is available basically everywhere. It is a wonderful book, and in my opinion, one of the best books ever written about Frank Zappa. At the top of the show, we heard 9 types of industrial pollution from the vinyl version of the Uncle Meat album by the Mothers of Invention. So now, without further ado, here is part 2 of our conversation with Pauline Butcher Bird, right here on the ZappaCast. Have you heard anything more about Moon's book, Andrew?
About Moon's book? Ah, because she was... No, I haven't. No, no, she said that she was writing about her childhood, wasn't she?
Yes, yeah. That's going to be interesting.
That will be a very good book. Yeah. That will be very good, I know, because I think her book, America the Beautiful, is a fantastic book. Have you read that?
I have, yeah.
I have, yeah.
I thought it was fantastic because she's so honest with herself. She seems to know who she is. I think it's brilliant. I mean, I'm not as capable of that, of revealing myself so well. I think it's marvellous.
Yeah, do you follow her on Twitter? Because she posts some hilarious tweets on there.
Does she know? I have not. What is her name on Twitter?
It's just Moon Zappa.
Oh, it's just Moon Zappa. Okay.
All right, well, I'll search. I'll follow her. Does she reply? Do you reply to her?
I don't communicate with her. I just follow her.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I always say, Dweezil's one of the nicest guys you could ever meet. That's what I always say about him.
Well, I think they all are. I think they all come across as fantastic people, and you have to give them credit. I think if there's anything one can say about them, they did a fantastic job, despite what Moon's complaints have been. They have actually turned out 4 fantastic children. And a lot of that goes to Gail, actually.
Yeah, you have to give a lot of credit to Gail for that. They did raise 4 unbelievable kids, so they're all successful in their own pursuits.
They're all so unaffected and unassuming and so straight, yep. And they can say what they mean and not beat about the bush. I think they reveal themselves for who they are. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think, you're absolutely right.
I always thought Armit was a bit more of a loose cannon. He was always, make comments. But when he and Dweezil were touring, it always seemed to be Dweezil was the sort of diplomat and would always tone him down a bit.
Oh, I haven't seen him in interviews at all.
No, well, he's carving out a nice little career for himself with Disney, isn't he, Armit?
Yeah, he has, yeah.
I believe so. I mean, he's settled down and, he's making a living. I think it's commendable. I mean, not that that's anything special. I mean, for God's sake, everybody in the world makes a living and goes to work. Maybe we should make that any special deal. But given the upbringing they had, they which was strange, they have all turned out remarkably well.
Thank you.
Diva in 200 Motels. Did you see her there?
I did not, unfortunately, because it...
On the wrong coast.
Yeah, I'm on the wrong continent, yeah, well, I was going to ask you, what did you think of 200 Motels? Because I know you were there. I've seen pictures.
Well, I thought it was good. I don't think it's his best piece of music. It's a shame it had to be that one and not one of his later compositions, personally. But it was good that it was staged, and I just felt very sad that he wasn't there to see it and hear it.
Do you think he would have appreciated the performance and the way it was done and all that?
I think he ought to have done. It's a bit rich, I think, the way he used to complain about the Philharmonics and the way they played his music. I suppose he had some reason to grouse. I suppose he did. And especially if he was paying for them to play his music. But I think he would have been pleased with that, don't you, Andrew?
Yeah, I think so. But had he been alive, it would have been a whole different other thing, wouldn't it? It would have, he would probably have rewritten huge chunks of it.
Yeah, probably.
Well,
Reorchestrated it, rearranged it so that you wouldn't be able necessarily to recognize them as the original pieces initially, yeah. You know.
Yeah, but as Scott Tunis was saying, you know, that they did, we haven't got Frank anymore, and what the other guys did with Kurt Morgan and people, what they were able to do and piece together was, outstanding, really.
Yeah, they did it, yeah. I mean, I've only heard and seen clips of the show, but, well, I have heard the whole thing, obviously, but yeah, I thought it was a pretty impressive achievement.
I saw the film again, and I didn't like it. I've seen it 5 times, and I alternate between liking it and not liking it each time I see it.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I mean, it's kind of hard to really, for me to really critique it properly, because, you know, I'm still one of those people who go, well, you know, it's Frank, he did this, you know, all that kind of stuff. But as somebody who was there at the time, Pauline, it's interesting to hear, you know, your thoughts on the movie, because it obviously was a project that Frank was kind of deeply involved in for at least, what, say, that year of 1970. When you were, you know...
For the music, it took him a long time to write the score.
Yeah, yeah.
And he wrote that after the Mothers broke up, which is really why he wanted to break... Was that... Yeah, that's right, yes. And the film itself was only shot over a week, and then he edited it very quickly. So it didn't take up a huge amount of his time, I don't think. And more than about half a year, the actual film...
Yeah, I think by the time it was, prepared, scripted, financed, and actually shot, probably about 6 months.
Yeah, it was, but I mean, when I saw it as a premiere, I wrote in my diary, I thought it was fantastic. It was absolutely brilliant, I thought. Mm-hmm. Then I saw it again as a video, and later on, and I didn't like it. Then I saw it again later as a DVD, and I loved it. And then I saw it in the cinema, and I didn't like it. So I guess it depends on my mood, but who cares what I think about it? Everybody else likes.
Well, that's true. Maybe it has something to do, originally I was going to say, maybe it has something to do with having seen it in the cinema and then seeing it on video, you know, two completely different experiences. But if you saw it in the cinema again, you know, then I suppose that negates that question.
Yes, it's a better film to watch in the comfort of your own room and sort of engulf in it, rather than watch it with a load of strange people in a big cinema. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt. I was slightly embarrassed because people kept walking out.
Oh, did they?
Oh, yeah, you saw that. That's right. You saw it just before the performance, didn't you? Last year, Pauline. It was shown on the South Bank, the film.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Did you go then?
No, I didn't, no. And they showed the true story of 200 Motels as well, didn't they?
I didn't see that one, no. I just saw the actual film. Yeah. Cinema was full, but they it was half empty when the film finished.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that affected my mood, I think. I think I got influenced by all these people. I was slightly embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
Did people pay, you know, did people have to buy tickets for it? They had to, yeah?
Yes, you did, yeah.
Oh, so they bought tickets and then walked out?
Yes.
That sounds amazing to me. You would at least have... I've suffered through the worst movies, some of the worst movies ever, just because I paid money to see them. I said, if I'm going to pay for pain, you know, I'm going to get all the pain that is coming to me. So I think Frank would appreciate that statement.
Festival Hall to be interviewed for a forthcoming DVD. So Do you know any more about that, Scott? I know both performances were filmed, I think, so I assume there is some sort of official release planned of the suites.
There was an official release planned, and I think it may have been put on the back burner. I know there is also talk about additional 200 Motels performances, and if those take place, they might possibly film them as well. So
yeah.
I don't think there's going to be any movement anytime soon to put out a DVD of the of the shows. But they were, yeah, they were shot in high definition, and those they have them. But I think with, as we see with a lot of projects, you know.
Yeah.
They get started and then they kind of disappear into the ether.
Ooh, the way you love me, lady. I get so hard now I could die. Ooh, the way you love me, sugar.
Pauline, do you remember anything about this? Frank assembled a 12 LP box set in 69, right after the Mothers broke up, called The History Uncollected Improvisations of the Mothers of Invention. He was going to put it out through the Playboy Record Club, I guess. And it never happened, although the albums were created. They actually were completed. Do you remember anything about that?
Unfortunately. That period, I didn't keep a diary, and I didn't write letters home. I got so absorbed into my life there, and I don't remember. It was a shame. That's why the book is all about the log cabin, because that's when I wrote all these long letters home. And then later on, once I moved away from the log cabin, I stopped writing my diary and I stopped writing letters, you know, once every 3 months instead of every week. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all those details were lost, and I don't actually remember it.
Yeah, that I've been trying to figure out what could have happened with those tapes because, you know, it was a project that at the time didn't come out because I guess it wasn't economically viable. But unfortunately, all the master tapes are all gone. You know, Frank cut them up and used them for other projects.
Yeah.
So,
yes, it rings the bell. The whole thing rings the bell in my mind. And I might have a look because I certainly didn't dwell on any of the music side of it. And I might have a look into that and see what I can find. But I don't actually remember it.
Yeah, there are bits and pieces of it out there, but that have surfaced. But for example, when Herbie Cohen passed away, some of his acetates came up for auction and went for big dollars, actually. And his acetate records, and you know, there was material from that box set in that collection. So, you know, the stuff is out there, but
I mean, obviously, Mrs. Zappa wouldn't have a say in anything happening with
that. No, that's true. I was always, you know, I always hoped that they could, but I guess they couldn't recompile it and release it anyway because some of that stuff is owned by Universal now.
Sometimes in the middle of the night, you get to feeling uptight and wish you were feeling all right. You toss and turn on your sweaty little gray teenage sheets in that little room of the psychedelic posters and the red bulb and the incense and your bead collection and your country song roundup books, and you cry your tiny sick tears. You know you gato. You've got to find some relief from the terrible ache that is clutching right at your heart. Because it's hurting you to your heart. And you're crying tiny sick tears. And you have to go downstairs, out of your bedroom, out into the hall, down to the living room, through the living room, to the kitchen, to the cookie jar, where you want to get your cookies. And you take the top off the cookie jar, and you stick your tiny sick hand in the cookie jar, and you reach around in the cookie jar to find a raisin cookie, a spongy one with a little plump raisins, little tactile sensation for your tiny sick fingers. Squeeze the raisin on the cookie, pull the cookie out of the jar, stuff the raisin into your eating hole, push it all the way in your eating hole. Now make your eating hole wrap itself around the tiny sick cookie. Scarf the cookie. Put the lid back on the jar. Go over to the ice box. Open the ice box. Pull out the box of milk. Open the box of milk into a triangular beak like that. Pull the little triangular beak up to your drinking hole. Up to your hole. Pour the white fluid from the drinking box into your hole. Close the beak. Reinsert the box into the ice box. Close the box door. Walk out of the kitchen, through the living room, back up the stairs. Past your sister's room. Past your brother's room. You take a mask from the ancient hallway. Make it down to your father's room, and you walk in, and your father, your tiny sick father, is beating his meat to a Playboy magazine. He's got it rolled into a tube, and he's got his tiny sick pud stuffed in the middle of it, right flat up against the centerfold. There he is, your father with a tiny sick erection. And you walk in and you say, "Father, I want to kill you." And he says, "Not now, son, not now."
What are you working on at the moment, Scott?
Well, I'm actually working on a book about the making of the Freakout album. And It is finished in draft stage.
What's in the book? Do you go back to before the record was made?
Yep.
You know, the beginning of the band and all that?
I do. As a matter of fact, I do. And I've been trying to get, actually, if I can still manage to do this. It's been very difficult to get a hold of people. You would think that it would be easy to get a hold of Roy Estrada, for example, because he's in jail in Texas.
Yeah.
But he's been, you know, it's been very difficult trying to convince them that I should talk to him about the book. And
you actually write to him then?
You know what? I haven't actually written to him. Maybe I should just write him a letter and see if
he will reply.
Yeah,
he will reply. I've written to him, and he's replied to me.
Oh yeah, I didn't.
You just write to him, care of the jail, and he replies.
Oh, I'll have to. Yeah, I didn't. For some reason, I didn't even think about that because I thought that the people at the prison were trying to sort of stymie me, but if he wanted to do it, yeah, that would be ideal, because I'd like to talk to somebody else about it, because Elliot Ingber, who was in the Mothers at that time also, doesn't answer his phone. Mick gave me his phone number, but he never answers his phone, and he doesn't have an answering machine.
He must be quite old now, isn't he?
Ingber, he's got to be certainly in his early 70s.
Oh, well, I thought he was older than that.
It might be. That's true. He could be. Because Ray Collins was how old when he passed away? I mean, he was somewhere around 80, I think. So, yeah, he could be older than that. But, yeah, he doesn't answer his phone, so...
I think Roy would be very pleased to hear from you.
Oh, I'd send him a letter. As a matter of fact, I'd do it today, because... you know, I've been trying to get... I mean, I know that what Roy's in jail for is horrible, but he's still Roy Estrada. And there are only a finite number of people who were there who could tell the tale. So
I think he's trying to write his own book, but I don't think, it's an easy task for him because he's having to do it on handwriting with, on... line pages of the notebook and stuff like that, but I tried to encourage him to continue to do it.
Yeah, do you have a regular correspondence with him?
No, I've had two letters from him, and I wrote back the third time, and I haven't heard this last one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if I've put him off or what's happened. I mean, for example, I was in touch with Art Tripp for ages and ages, for mm-hmm. about 3 years, and we had really constant connection, and then all of a sudden he cut me off, so I don't quite know what happens. I don't know whether I say the wrong thing suddenly, or do the wrong thing, or it's just something nothing to do with me, and it's something else, but it is odd. I mean, he may write yet. It's a while, but it's like the other two times he wrote straight back, I got letters straight back.
There you go, Scott. You should do it.
Definitely. Oh yeah, I definitely need to do it then, because yeah. I called the jail twice, and both times the sort of attitude, whoa, what'd you want to talk to him for? And
yeah.
You know, apparently they don't like him very much.
Oh, well, I think a letter might do it, and then he would tell you how you could phone him. He will give you the information on how to phone him.
Unless he just doesn't want to talk about it because he's writing his own book, which is possible, but...
No. I know he would... I'm almost sure. I mean, he's in jail, so any communication with the outside world must be welcome.
I would imagine, yeah, because he's, you know, unfortunately, he's not going to see the light of day outside of jail ever again, probably.
Thank you.
back, and he said to me, "I always fancied you when we were there at the and but I was too afraid that you wouldn't look at me."
Mm-hmm.
And of course I wrote back and said, "Well, I had no idea. I had no idea."
Conscious of his weight in the early days, because he was
I guess he would have been, because all the others were very scrawny. But he wasn't as heavy as he is now, of course, or later. But he was a little plump. But so was Lowell George.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they were actually obviously very good friends. They went on to form Little Feet. So they obviously, you know, they certainly had that in common. And
Roy Estrada's contribution to the Mothers of Invention was wonderful, wasn't it? It was, you know, his singing with that high soprano voice.
Yes.
Was magnificent, I thought. It was wonderful.
I was just watching footage of him singing with them this morning. In some ways, he embodied the spirit of that band as much as anybody else.
He did.
You know, I mean, and I've always, I have heard this, and I don't know if either of you have ever heard this, but and I'm trying to remember if I heard Roy say this in an interview, maybe, but there was a thing where Roy apparently had quit the Mothers just prior to the dissolution of the band in August of 69, and that may have had something to do with Frank throwing in the towel. I don't know how true that is, but I read it somewhere, actually. It was kind of implied that maybe that's why Frank ended that band in that way, because after Roy decided to leave, he just said, well, that's enough, basically.
Are you saying that Roy was not on that trip when they went to Canada? I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah, no, he was there, but he had, I don't know if it was just before that or during the trip to Canada, but he had said in an interview that he had told Frank that he was quitting just prior to the dissolution of the band. And I wonder, you know, if that may have had something, you know, something to do with Frank deciding at that moment that was, you know, enough. Because he was certainly very fond of Roy, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I think so. But I have not heard anyone else mention, I mean, Jimmy Carr Black was very friendly with Roy, and mm-hmm. they were all very close. And I have not heard any of them say that in any of their interviews.
That Roy had left?
That Roy was considering leaving.
Yeah, I have to find it. It may have been, I think it was Roy himself who said it. And it's always stuck out in my mind because of the timing.
Yeah.
You know.
But he was there. He was there. I thought he was anyway. I mean, in that trip, because I went over there.
Yep. Yeah, oh no, he was definitely there. There was no, you know, they didn't have any other options in terms of the bass player, so.
Why did he want to leave? What was his reason?
Ah, oh, hang on. It's actually from my interview that I did with him.
Oh, it is?
I interviewed Roy a long time ago, only by email, and he said, "I quit the Mothers the last part of 1969. Frank didn't want me to quit. Towards the middle of 1970, I got together with Lowell, Richie and Billy, forming Little Feet." So he actually talks about leaving the Mothers before Frank disbanded them.
Do you know, I'm not sure if that is accurate. I really do question that, because he was there at the meeting when they had the breakup, and he was just as devastated as everybody else. I'm not sure if his memory is correct there. It might have been earlier, you know, when he wanted to leave, and Frank would have talked him out. Well, maybe it was then. I don't know. But it doesn't quite ring true to me. It doesn't quite fit. But, you know... Did he say why?
No, it was just a comment that I'd obviously glossed over and didn't pick up on it. So,
right.
There you
right.
go. There's something else to ask him. When you write to him, Scott.
Yeah, I actually should, because he probably will...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he'd probably remember that story, but or tell that story even. But yeah, you may be right, Pauline. If he was there in the meeting where the band was dissolved, then, you know, I mean, I don't know why he would be devastated if he had already quit.
Yes, I mean, he did not have anything more to do with Frank after that. But maybe he was already in negotiation with Lyle George, maybe. I don't know. Maybe he was. I mean, they were all fed up with each other, really, for quite a long time. So it's possible. You know, and who am I to say, well, he's got that muddled up. So I think go with it. Go with it.
Huh. Well, then, yeah. I've always thought, well, if that's true, then the timing could be significant because... You know, Frank could have just thrown in the towel at that point.
He could have done, yeah.
Because they survived Ray Collins leaving, but, you know, that was...
Numerous times, didn't he? Ray left loads of times, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, there's whole albums like We're Only In It for the Money that he's not on, so...
Yeah.
And, yeah, that would have been recorded just before you met him, as a matter of fact, Pauline. But Ray was on that trip, that tour that they did when you met Frank. Ray was back at that point because he had just come back for the European tour.
Yes, he was. Yes,
but he had.
But he was in and out. He was in and out of the group all the time. He kept leaving and coming back, as everyone knows. Yeah.
Thank you.
I just want to ask both of you how you both got into being Zappa fans.
My story is not as interesting as Andrew's is, so I'll tell it first. When I was 15, I had a friend of mine who was a first generation Zappa fan, going back to the Freak Out album. A huge collector, lived in town here, as a matter of fact, and he kept telling me, because I had sort of different and more interesting, I guess, advanced musical tastes, and he said, you have to listen to Zappa. And I heard this for a couple of years, but it was, at the time, it was almost impossible for me to get any of Frank's older albums, because I like to start at the beginning and then go forward. But the albums at the time were like $50 in the mid-80s, which was a lot of money back then. And finally, when they started to come out on CD, I got a CD player, and I started to hear these albums, and I just immediately connected with them, because I thought, well, here is a guy who understands me. For some reason, I just remember thinking that very clearly. Like
Do you remember what the first album was you had?
Yep, Freak Out.
It was Freak Out.
And I thought, you know, the musical concepts and the sociological bent in the lyrics and stuff, you know, as a teenager, I felt that he understood, you know, what that American teenage experience was like for me. And I looked at it as a very personal thing, you know, I felt very connected.
What year was this?
This would be 86, I believe.
Really?
It was.
Late
as that? Yep. As a matter of fact, yeah, because I was 15 at the time, so yeah, that would be 86.
Well, I'm amazed, because I was always under the impression that Freak Out spoke to young people in the 60s. I didn't dream it spoke to young people in the 80s.
Oh, yeah, and it still speaks to people now, because I've played it for my daughter's friends, and they're in their, you know, their kind of late teens now. But they're all very, you know, they all love that album.
And, really?
Yeah, and it's something that...
It's timeless, isn't it? I'd suggest it's timeless, then.
It's very timeless, yeah. They absolutely... In some ways, it is still ahead of its time, also, in some of those pieces that are on that album. So, you know, I've heard comments from my daughter's friends like, I never knew such a thing existed. So, you know, I mean, it's just a question of finding the people. But if you find them, if the music can find them somehow, or they can find the music, it's there and it's timeless.
So were you one of the disenfranchised teenage boys then?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I was, yeah, very disenfranchised by the, you know, kind of mainstream, you know, American life. So when I heard something like that, you know, it seems ridiculous, almost silly to say now, because American life has gotten so, you know, pop culture and stuff has gotten so over the top ridiculous. But yeah, at the time, I just thought I had discovered this person who was sort of writing for me. I mean, I knew consciously it wasn't, but, you know, it felt very personal to me. And it still does, you know, I still relate to it on that level. That's why I think, you know, if kids can find this stuff, you know, they will always appreciate it, you know, in that sense. And I think a lot of Frank's stuff got me through, you know, the high school and that, you know, that kind of a tough period that every kid goes through, you know.
Don't you think that's a bit of genius to have written that, to actually, that's what that album does to so many people? It connects in that particular way into their personal lives, which doesn't normally happen with albums, does it?
That's true. I can't think of anybody else that has grabbed me in such a personal way and spoken to me specifically in such a personal way as Frank's as certainly Freak Out did. All those early Mothers albums really spoke to me in a very profound way. Yeah, I think it is. It's absolute genius. Frank knew who he was talking to, and those people are still, you know, they're still, you know, they're people being born now who will grow up to be people who could easily connect with these things. So, yeah, I think that's absolute. That is genius.
Going back again to see that girl I left behind me when I went out to see this great big world. I hope that she feels the same about me as she did before I went out to see this great big world. I know I love that girl and I hope that she still wants me to be her one and only guy. Going back to see that girl I love and I'm so happy I could cry. Going back to take her in my arms again and tell her that I'm not gonna leave her anymore. I love her so much I just can't wait until I touch her and I'm not gonna leave her anymore. I know I love that girl and I hope that she still wants me to be her one and only guy. Going back to see that girl I love and I'm so happy I could cry. I'm looking forward to that day when she will love me in her way. All day long I sit and pray, someday soon I'll hear her say.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, and then I heard Burnt Weenie and Hot Rats, so it was more the music for me. Burnt Weenie was the first album I bought, and I was I was a bit younger than you as well, Scott, so I was about 12 or something, and this was like nothing I'd heard before, you know, having been brought up on the Beatles and getting into sort of progressive rock music and the like. Mm-hmm. Hearing Hot Rats, I think that was the one that turned me, really, and that was, so I started buying... Then obviously I heard the Flo and Eddie stuff, so the scatological lyrics, obviously, when you're a teenage boy, have an impact. And then it just evolved from there, really.
So did you actually ever go to the early ones, like Freak Out and Absolutely Free?
Yeah, I worked my way backwards.
You went backwards, yeah.
As Scott was saying, in the 70s and the 80s, you know, it's difficult to get some of the vinyl albums. So you know, actually picking up the records was difficult. I actually ended up getting things like Reuben and the Jets on pirate tapes.
Oh yeah.
I definitely from Roxy and elsewhere I bought every album as it was released, but the early stuff I just went back and slowly picked up on that.
So that stuff wasn't available in England at the time.
Not like really available, no, in the 70s, no.
But Andrew, were you alone in this or did you have friends?
A school friend who actually introduced me to those early albums, and then he went off it all, didn't really like it, and so I carried on. And yeah, it was quite a lonely thing for me because my brother didn't like it at all, thought it was horrible, And yes, it was a lonely pursuit for many years for me.
Yeah, no, it was pretty lonely for me too, but my friends regularly had this music shoved down their throats. They couldn't escape it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the first few concerts I went to, I managed to drag some people along, but they never returned. It was always me trying to encourage other people. It was a long time before I found like-minded people, really.
If you decide to leave me, it's all over. If you decide to leave me, it's all over. I tried to make you happy. I gave you all my love. There's nothing left for me to do but cry.
And that's our show, but before we go, I'd like to give you the list of the musical selections you heard in this program. We heard Eric Dolphy Memorial Barbecue from the Weasels Rip My Flesh album from the 2012 Universal remaster of that album by the Mothers of Invention. We heard Lucy Seduction of a Bored Violinist and Postlude from 200 Motels. We heard the single version of Magic Fingers. The Cookie Jar Lecture, also known as Tiny Sick Tears, taken from the Artisan Acetate, which is an acetate of material that Frank had prepared for use in the deluxe 10-record box set, The History and Collected Improvisations of the Mothers of Invention, which, of course, was never released. Prelude to the Afternoon of a Sexually Aroused Gas Mask from the Weasels Rip My Flesh album. Uncle Meat and O in the Sky from The Late Show at the Royal Festival Hall in London on October 25th, 1968. I'm So Happy I Could Cry, a 1965 demo which can be heard on the 2004 album Joe's Corsage, and Stuff Up the Cracks from the original vinyl mix of the 1968 album Cruising with Reuben and the Jets. If you like what you hear and you don't have it in your collection, go out and buy the stuff. That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. The Zappacast was produced and edited by Scott Parker, Andrew Greenaway, Mick Eakers, and Scott Fisher. Be sure to check out Andrew's website at www.idiotbastard.com for all the latest Zappa news, and also to purchase Andrew's book, Zappa the Hard Way, the definitive account of the 1988 Frank Zappa Broadway the Hard Way tour. For those of you interested in obtaining my Zappa books, my website is located at www.spbpublishing.webs.com, and if you order the books directly from me, I'll sign them for you. My books are also available from www.gndsmusic.com, purveyors of the finest Zappa merchandise anywhere, as well as www.amazon.com and many other right-thinking booksellers. And you should also check out Mick Eaker's excellent site on Frank's gear at www.zappasgear.com. And for more information about Scott Fisher, you can go to fishersflickr.com. That's F-I-S-C-H-E-R-S. FLICKER.com. Scott is a very wonderful musician and songwriter, and you can check out some of his music at that website. If you wish to contact us, drop us a line at MOI1969, that's 1969, at SNET.net. On behalf of Andrew Greenaway, Mick Eakers, and Scott Fisher, this is Scott Parker saying thank you again for listening. And until next time, good night, boys and girls.
Thanks a lot. Good night.